Morning, everyone. Sure, it doesn't take a detective to work out that I'm not from here. My husband and I moved back, he's from Belfast, back to Northern Ireland 6 months ago. And it's a real honour to come and speak in Ballymena. The reason being, when I first started at Tear Fund about 7.5 years ago, I was sent over to Northern Ireland to be taught how it's done. And the first place I came was Ballymena. So it's a great honour to be able to come here and speak to you guys after having learnt from what goes on here, the Mid-Antrim Walk and all other kinds of activities, to learn from the best, to be able to come and speak to the best. Shh, don't tell anyone I said that. So I'd love to ask you, what is your favourite board game? Anyone got any keen board gamers here? Yes? Chess? Yeah? Oh gosh, I don't even know how to play chess. That's very highbrow. Anything else? Scrabble? There we go, I'm also awful at Scrabble. Anyone else?
Rummy Cub.
Sorry?
Rummy Cub.
Rummy
Cub.
Cub. Okay, oh, it's just called Rummy, I think. I know it. Okay, all very good board games. My favourite is a little bit less. Well, I think it's pretty simple. Monopoly. Does anyone play Monopoly? Do you know there's over 200 versions of Monopoly now? But I just learned from the bog standard version. And when I was a child, my parents used to borrow a house up in the Lake District in England, and inevitably we'd go there for our summer holiday and it would rain. And the only board games that they did have were Scrabble, which I wasn't very good at, and Monopoly. So it always ensued that my summer holiday basically was spent most afternoons spending a very long game of Monopoly, because Monopoly always seems to last quite a long time. That is where I discovered my competitive instinct, and the fact that sometimes I quite liked to hide the money that I had so that people didn't know how much money he had. But unfortunately, they had a glass coffee table, so anyone who looked under the board could see the 500s that I'd hidden there. But imagine you're playing Monopoly, you're playing with a friend, and they get Park Lane, and then they get Mayfair, and then they end up with three of the stations, and you know you're not doing very well. And then they start building. So they've got their houses, and then they've got their hotels, and eventually you end up bankrupt. Now, in my situation, I would probably not want to play again, because I don't like playing games that I can't win. But if your friend persuades you, yes, let's play again, let's set it back and have a go. So you go and make a cup of tea or have a drink, and then you come back to your board, and the board is set up just as it was before. Your friend still has Park Lane and Mayfair and all the hotels, and you're starting and you're bankrupt. How would you feel? I'd probably tell them that that wasn't fair. But the reality is, a game of Monopoly where you come back to it and you're bankrupt and somebody else has all the hotels is very similar to the way that life plays out in our world today. Each generation either inherits the wealth or the poverty from the previous one. And it's a very difficult cycle to break. People like Sabel lives in Nepal. This isn't him, but this is a goat, which I'm going to explain in a minute. But Sabel lives in Nepal, and he lives in a rural community. There is 37 homes in his village, and all the roads to his village are impassable by car. So nobody can drive to where he lives. It's very difficult to get food, to be able to find the supplies that he might need. They have to walk everywhere. And for Sabel, they rely on farming, agriculture, and having livestock. And Sabel did have 17 goats, 4 cows, and 2 oxen. So he's, you know, doing okay. And in Nepal, goats and cows and oxen are a little bit like cash in the bank. So a goat is worth a fair amount of money, and you keep that goat, you look after them, and then you cash them in when you need it. So it's a little bit like your children's university fund, or that accessible amount of income which you can use when your child gets married for a dowry. So you keep your livestock because they're very valuable. You look after them, make sure that they're kept healthy. But for Sobel, the kind of unthinkable happened. 9 of his 17 goats died, just like that. They had some unknown disease that he couldn't work out what it was, and they were gone. That's 9 goats out of his 17, which is the equivalent of about £500 that he'd just lost. And £500 to us might not sound like that much, but for Sobel, it was a huge amount. And he panicked because these goats have got a disease and he doesn't know what it is. And it's not like the vet can come up the road in their 4x4 and check them out. It's not like he can afford that for that, or that he even has access to that kind of care. So immediately he decided to sell 6 more because he wanted to get rid of them if they had a disease that he couldn't treat. But he sold those 6 more at a much lower price, which meant that he wasn't the money that he had in the bank with the goats. He got a lot less than he was expecting. And he lived in this fear that maybe more of his animals would get this disease. What would happen, this hidden disease, he didn't know what it was. What would happen if that got to his 4 cows and his 2 oxen? See, life for people like Sobel is they're on a cliff edge. Anything could go wrong, and it could hit them and they could hit rock bottom. And that's the generation after generation. Poverty is inherited by families or people who have wealth inherit them, just like the Monopoly board game. Do that one. Okay. So the board is already stacked against Sobel. But in the Old Testament, we see that God set up laws to ensure that his chosen people wouldn't be the case. He inherently built into the law a reset button, which meant that the board wasn't stacked in anyone's favour. That it was reset, it was cleared, the hotels go back to the box, and everybody gets what they started with. This reset button in God's law was set for every 50 years. Once a generation, we would see this reset. And it's called the Year of the Jubilee. Anyone who had sold some of their land because they were poor and they needed to make some money, that land would be returned to them. Anyone who had stacked up debts from loans that they couldn't pay back, those debts would be cancelled. And anyone who had had to sell themselves into slavery because they weren't able to provide for their family and themselves, they would be set free. The year of Jubilee was such a crucial year in the Mosaic Law. And we've been thinking about the year of Jubilee a lot at Tear Fund, because 2018 is Tear Fund's 50th anniversary. We've been around for 50 years, and over those 50 years we've been trying to reset the board for those people who are living in the most extreme poverty. We've been trying to break that cycle of poverty and enable for these people to flourish. And so if we look at Leviticus 25, this is where the Jubilee is outlined in the Old Testament. You probably can't read it up there, but if you can, you can turn to it in your Bibles, but I'm going to read it out for you. So Leviticus 25, starting from verse 8, says this: "Count 7 Sabbath years, 7 times 7 years, so that the 7 Sabbath years amount to a period of 49 years. Then sound the trumpet everywhere on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. Sound the trumpet throughout your land. Consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. Each of you is to return to your family property and to your own clan. The 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. Do not sow, do not reap what grows of itself, or harvest the untended vines. For it is a jubilee, and it is to be holy for you. Eat only what is taken directly from the fields. In this year of jubilee, everyone is to return to their own property. If you sell land to any of your own people or buy land from them, do not take advantage of each other. You are to buy from your own people on the basis of the number of years since the jubilee, and they are to sell to you on the basis of the number of years left for harvesting crops. When the years are many, you are to increase the price, and when the years are few, you are to decrease the price.
because what is really being sold to you is the number of crops. Do not take advantage of each other, but fear your God. I am the Lord your God. Follow my decrees and be careful to obey my laws, and you will live safely in the land. Then the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and live there in safety. You may ask, what will we eat in the seventh year if we do not plant or harvest our crops? I will send you such a blessing in the sixth year that the land will yield enough for 3 years. While you plant during the eighth year, you will eat from the old crop and will continue to eat it from it until the harvest of the ninth year comes in. The land must not be sold permanently, because the land is mine and you reside in my land as foreigners and strangers. So the 50th year, the year of Jubilee, was a very important one. It says in verse 10, consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a Jubilee for you. The 50th year was a sacred year. It was consecrated. It was marked by the sound of the trumpet on the Day of Atonement. It was a holy year. And it was a year that looked like land being returned back to its rightful owner if it had been leased, the release of Hebrew slaves and the cancellation of debt. God was restoring things so that people could flourish again. For those people who were in poverty, they would be able to flourish. For those people who had earned a lot, they were able to sell back the land or to give back the land, knowing that they had paid a fair price for it. So the bits about ensuring that you count the number of years of harvest, not the value of the land. It ensured an ongoing equal distribution of the land, which protected people who fell on hard times. It was that reset button inbuilt every generation for the people to be able to reset so that they could flourish. So that economically people were able to move forward, but also socially. That communities and clans that had land together were able to come back together. That family were brought back together. And it's really important to note that this is about restoration, not charity. It was giving families an opportunity to go back to their land, to give them the skills or the tools that they needed, their land, their freedom, their cancellation of debt, to be able to help themselves, to provide for themselves. It wasn't about depending on others. It was about restoration, not a handout, but just being given something that enabled them to be able to lift themselves out of poverty. And the heart of this passage is verse 23, where it says, the land must not be sold permanently, because the land is mine and you reside in my land as foreigners and strangers. God's making two key points here. The land belongs to God. He says the land must not be sold permanently because the land is mine. The land belongs to God. It was his and it was a gift to Israel. And we see this throughout the Old Testament, that the land is a symbol of their relationship with God. When Israel obeyed, they lived there. And when they disobeyed, they were expelled from the land. The land is God's and it's a gift. And that the Israelites were strangers and sojourners in that land. They're God's guests. They're resident aliens in the land. God is the landlord, and they're the tenants. So just as God has shown kindness and generosity to his people by giving them the gift of the land, of enabling them to be strangers in that land, to be tenants, he is encouraging them to show that love and that generosity and that kindness to their brothers and sisters through the Jubilee year. They are recognizing that all they have belongs to God. It's not theirs forever. It is God's, and we should steward it as God has asked us to. Now, the year of the Jubilee, great reset principle written in the law, actually never happened. And in Isaiah, when Isaiah is prophesying about the Messiah, Isaiah 61 takes the concept of the Jubilee and he broadens it out. So Isaiah 61 says this, and I'm sure it's a familiar passage to many of you. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour and the day of vengeance of our God. This passage is really closely linked to Leviticus 25 and the idea of Jubilee. The year of the Lord's favour refers to the year of the Jubilee. And Isaiah is prophesying that the Messiah will come. There'll be a time when anointed one will come to proclaim good news, to provide freedom, to provide sight for the blind. And that's not just once in a generation opportunity. It's not just once every 50 years. The Messiah is coming to proclaim an era of restoration, of ongoing freedom, not just a release every 50 years. When he says to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour and the day of vengeance of our God, we see in Luke 4 that Jesus outlines that he is the Messiah. And he talks about proclaiming the year of the Lord's favour, which is the start of it. And the day of vengeance is when Jesus will return. So we're in that era, in the era of restoration, an era where people will be set free, where we will see good news. It's a little bit like, maybe stretching the Monopoly analogy a little bit thin, but it's a little bit like jail in Monopoly's Gone. Instead of going to jail and having to wait to roll the dice to see freedom, you just get set free. Freedom's accessible for all of us now, not in 50 years' time. So the passage in Isaiah is broadening out the concept of Jubilee to be not just about economic release, but to be about spiritual and emotional restoration as well. And then that's why Jesus makes it clear that he has come to outwork that. So Luke 4, which is my favorite, one of my favorite passages in the Gospels, Jesus turns up to his home synagogue. He's preaching to the home crowd. And he comes on the Sabbath to the synagogue, and as a rabbi, he stands up and he reads from the scroll of Isaiah, and he says this: "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour." And then he stops there. He rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. The eyes of everyone on the synagogue were fastened on him. He began by saying to them, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." I love this passage because it's Jesus' first gig. Like, it's his first public teaching experience that is written about in the Gospels. And he goes to his home crowd and he is declaring what he has come to do. He is declaring his manifesto. It's often known as the Nazarene Manifesto. But rather than being a political manifesto that's written down and never outworked, Jesus says, "This scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. It's happening now. I have come to bring good news to the poor. I have come to bring freedom and recovery of sight to the blind." Jesus is saying he's come to bring it all. He's coming to bring the Jubilee theory, the law, and he's coming to bring it economically but spiritually. And when we read this passage, we often go, good news to the poor is the gospel, and freedom from the captives is freedom from sin. And it is, but it's also not just spiritual, it's material as well. It's about bringing good news to the poor, which is about good news for our long-term salvation, but it's also good news in the here and now. And about freedom from captives, it's freedom from our sin, but it's freedom from literal chains as well. And that's what Tearfund's about. We're about reflecting that holistic nature of what Jesus came to bring, physical, emotional, and spiritual. Monopoly just moved away from being about land and property and to being about who you are. Are you the boot or the top hat? And apparently there's now a T-Rex. but it's about who we are and what we have. And we see this throughout the Gospels, that Jesus physically restored people as well as forgiving their sins. So that's been our heartbeat for the last 50 years. And we can put it anyway, material and spiritual poverty, integral mission. We are about the person and their spirit and their heart. We're about the holistic. So in this year, our 50th year, as we think about the principles of the Jubilee, we are declaring that at Tear Fund, we won't stop until poverty stops. Because we are committed to outworking Jesus' manifesto. And so we're going to watch a quick short film, which just kind of says it better than I do, about why we won't stop. At Tear Fund, we believe to stop extreme poverty, we need to see restoration of relationships. Whether that's a restoration of a relationship with God, or our relationship with ourselves and how we perceive ourselves, or our relationships with one another, or our relationships with the land below our feet, God's creation. And we have seen countless individuals and communities see that restoration, experience restoration to lift themselves out of extreme poverty. And in the last 50 years, there's been some great news. The number of people living in extreme poverty around the world has halved. In the last 20 or so years, the number of children who have access to primary education in developing countries has gone up to 91%. And the number of children dying before the age of 5 from preventable diseases has been halved. We have seen huge change, and we have seen people's lives transformed through the work of the local church all around the world. And that's thanks to God, and it's thanks to your commitment, to your generosity to help the church all around the world to tackle poverty. Let me tell you what this looks like in Nepal. Nepal is one of the poorest countries in the world. About 80% of the population live in rural areas. It's one of the poorest countries in Asia. Over half of families in Nepal have one migrant family member who lives away from them, who is sending back remittances to support their family. I went to Nepal a number of years ago now, and you could see absent in many families somebody, whether that's a husband, a father, some family member who is in Dubai or is in India or is in somewhere unknown, hoping that they will receive money back to them to support their family, because the economy there just isn't strong enough to be able to support everybody. And because of that, the delights or the hopes from trying to find work elsewhere means that about 7,000 people are trafficked every year out of the country. And the border between Nepal and India is really it's not really controlled, which means it's very easy for people to pass through to India. And the expectation is that somebody is going to take them to a wonderful job, which means that they can support their family, and it doesn't happen. See, poverty means that people have blinders on for what is going on, because all they're looking for is to be able to to help their family to be able to lift themselves out of the situation they're in. And then to add to this situation, at 11:56 on Saturday 25th of April 2015, Nepal was hit with a huge earthquake measuring 7.8 on the Richter scale, and many earthquakes following that. And the crucial thing to note is that that time on a Saturday, the Christians in Nepal, they were in church, like us. Church happens on Saturdays in Nepal. So churches full of people were struck by the earthquake. 5.6 million people were affected, 8,617 people were killed. Hitting an already fragile society, an already fragile economy, meant that people suddenly had no homes, had no access to food, had no way of contacting those family members who were around the world. And our partner, UMN, which is United Missions Nepal, it's one of the oldest mission agencies in Nepal. They're working through local churches and local partners, and they gather church leaders together to bring unity and to get them to think about what a way forward might look like. So this is an example of what it looks like in Nepal. It's a very difficult geography to navigate. It's very difficult to get anywhere. And when we say at Jesus, TIFF, and we're following Jesus where the need is greatest, we often means that we're following him in the most remote places, and we find his church and his church leaders there already. My husband recently went to Nepal to visit UMN. He's a filmmaker and he does a few films for Tear Fund. And he told me about, they went to one of the most remote places. So they drove on this road, on a 4x4 whilst they were building the road. So they got to the point at the end of the road where the diggers were cutting into the rock to try and build the rest of the road, and they couldn't go any further. So they left the car there. They then walked up a riverbed, which was in monsoon season is completely impassable. They walked across suspension bridges. He had a Sherpa who was carrying his equipment because they were traveling so far. And then they had to stay there overnight because they had no way of getting back in a day. He was totally out of contact. I couldn't contact him. Up in the foothills of the Himalayas. He said it was beautiful, but it's one of the most furthest remote places he's ever been. And imagine if you're there and your goat dies and you have no access to a vet, no access to be able to just sort things out, very little ability to be able to get health care for yourself or for your family. This is where people are really on the balance between being able to support themselves and when disaster strikes. So when an earthquake hits, you can imagine how vulnerable these people are. So when we remember Sabal with the goats, for Sabal, thankfully, there was relief because UMN is working with seven churches in that area. And it's brought the churches together to look at what the needs of the community are. And they set up an animal care day, which meant they were able to go house to house to care for people's animals, which means Sabal was able, with his one remaining goat, to check and sort out whatever the disease was, and he knew that he then had access to these people who could help. Alongside that, the church leaders are working with the local district council. And again, when I was in Nepal, we met a church leader who said, "No one wants anything to do with us. We're basically completely the weirdos in community. The church isn't embedded in the community like it is in Africa. It's not trusted because they accept anyone of any caste. They do things differently." And so in order for the church to be able to reach out to its community, it needs to build its trust. And one of the things that the church did that I visited was they cleared up rubbish in the community, because it's only the Dalits, the very lowest of the caste structure, who are able to touch rubbish. So those people of different castes collecting rubbish and clearing that community suddenly meant that they were something different. They were potentially people to be trusted. So UMN is helping these churches to be able to meet the needs of their community, to be able to gain the trust of the local councils to work out what needs to happen in that community, which then means that people begin to walk through the doors of the church. So the church Leaders are trying to do advocacy in their local government, but they're also teaching people how to build earthquake-resistant houses. And you see on this picture, think really simple things like building foundations deeper and building the frames of the houses within what the house frame itself, so that when an earthquake strikes, you stand in that door frame and you are protected. And so when we build earthquake-resistant houses, we might build one, but then we train a stonemason to build them, and then they train someone else to build them. So it goes on and on and on, rather than us just giving someone a house. We're giving people the skills to be able to change their own situation. It's not handouts or aid. It's about equipping them with the tools and training that they need. Just like God intended in the Jubilee, people aren't receiving charity, but they're giving a means to support themselves, a way to reset the board. Sabala and his community's story is a story of redemption and restoration. I think the next picture is Sabal with his goats. Wasn't a great quality picture, but there you can see him. And in his left hand, he has the medicine that he needs to be able to look after his livestock. But also in his community, they now have access to veterinary care, but they are working out what it looks like for the local council to build roads in that area, what it looks like to build earthquake-resistant houses so that they're safe when earthquake hits. And as I said, there's seven churches that are working through this. And this work is actually the project that the Mid-Antrim Walk is supporting this year, and which means that so 7,350 people will directly benefit from this training and this work, which is the same number of people who are trafficked every year from Nepal. And over 17,000 people will be able to, in that community, will be directly benefiting. As Jesus set out his mission in Luke 4, it is now our mission as his body, as his gathered disciples in church. So I want to read Isaiah 61 over us as we think about how we might outwork Jesus' manifesto and the Jubilee principles. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on us because the Lord has anointed us to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent us to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release from the darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. In Tirfan's 50th year, we have a vision to see 5 million people released from material and spiritual poverty. And we're declaring we won't stop until poverty stops. So I want to invite you to join us, to recommit yourselves today, this year, to saying you won't stop. We won't stop until we see poverty stop. And whether that's giving generously, whether that's praying, whether that's taking action, whether that's being part of the Mid-Antrim Walk to be able to help this many people benefit from the training. I want you to just think about what you might be part of and just take a second now to think about what it looks like to say we won't stop.